Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest news from Libya and speak with Ali Abdallatif Hamida, Chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and author of The Making of Modern Libya. We will discuss the end game of the revolution that has toppled 42 years of dictatorship, leaving many questions unanswered about what will fill the political vacuum in Libya. Then we will look further into Libya's uncertain future and what Libya might look like in 10 years. Daniel Serwa, a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, joins us. He worked on post-war stability in the Balkans, and we will discuss the possibility of human rights abuses and retribution, as well as who exactly are Libya's National Transition Council and who do they represent. Then finally, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg joins us. He is a former presidential advisor and U.S. ambassador to Morocco, and we'll look into the broader shifting landscape in the Middle East and how the fall of another dictator to the Arab Spring will impact Syria and its neighbors. Joining us now is Ali Abdallatif Hamida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Ali Abdallatif Hamida.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me again.
And it's good to catch up with you again, and particularly on this day, which is, I guess, pretty much the end of this 42-year-old dictatorship. Today, the rebels took the compound. I saw an amusing video of a Berber warrior wearing Gaddafi's hat with all of its gold scrambled eggs on it and wearing a huge gold chain and this big kind of mace that he was carrying. But, of course, they don't have the dictator yet. They've got his clothes.
Yes, it's been a while since we spoke last time. And I think, if I recall, I said then that Gaddafi and his regime lost the moral battle. Since then, they lost international support. And now we're witnessing they are losing the military battle.
Well, that's notwithstanding that the son appeared out of nowhere. He was supposed to have been captured, according to the rebels, and then he shows up. And it was quite surreal what he was saying to the press there that are holed up in the Rioux Hotel, which is surrounded by Gaddafi loyalists. Saif al-Islam was telling the reporters, oh, you know, let's go out to the neighborhood, you know, the safest neighborhood where you get the best nightclubs and it's really the hot spots. I mean, I thought that I was actually watching somebody who was completely deranged. I mean, we always thought that the father was off the wall, but the son seems to be equally delusional.
Yes, yes, indeed. And I think it was not only he was turned to be a big disappointment, and he turned to be somebody who's like his father, you know, since the uprising began. But also, this whole thing was a ruse, a deflection cooked by Saif al-Islam in a theatrical, kind of almost like a movie-like, calling the council and also to the media, say, you know, he was arrested by somebody, his aide, we know now, and then trying to use that as a ploy to say, hey, I'm free, and we know that they had no access to international media. So I think what we discovered today is that it was a ploy by Saif al-Islam, and unfortunately, theatrical, almost kind of surreal speech that he gave today was just laughable because the regime is completely bankrupt, except the fact, of course, Libyan South is still controlled by the Gaddafi brigades. That's, we're talking about central Libya and southern Libya, where people are being basically really terrorized by these brigades.
So, in other words, once the capital settles down and we find out a little bit more about this government and its ability to hold the factions together, because, you know, what seems to be apparent now is that it was largely the Westerners who won the military victory, and the Easterners have been the ones that have been getting all the support from the international community, and they don't seem to have gotten very far. And I'm wondering whether that's a potential fault line in the future. But what you're telling us here, Professor Ali Abdallatif Hamida, is that the South is largely in Gaddafi's control, and that's a big chunk of territory, isn't it?
It is. And I think because we know that in Sirte, for example, this is his home city where he was born near that city, and also in Sabha, he had his own tribe. who are armed to the teeth, beside two or three major security brigades that are still intact in these two regions. So it's not over, but I think the liberation of Tripoli is tremendous symbolic victory for the revolution. And today, the attack against the Bab al-Aziziyya compound, Gaddafi's headquarters, is tremendous boost to the revolution. So we're talking about the city that has 2 million people, really the heart of Libya. And I was praying that the city will not be destroyed or burned like Baghdad or other places. And the rebels and the revolutionaries showed tremendous ability to coordinate with each other. And their plan was very impressive, I should say.
So you're not worried then about fissures between the Western rebels, who seem to be much more militarily effective than the Eastern rebels?
Oh, I am worried, Ian. I think the big battle now is just facing us. I think getting rid of the Gaddafi regime was very, very tough. But the challenge is now for the leaders of the uprising is to work together to make sure that property and institutions and functions of society is not destroyed, and also not factionalism. Now the common enemy is being defeated. I'm very, very concerned, and I think one way to I'm concerned about is I want to see tremendous awareness of the challenges ahead, because Libya could be a model for the region. Even though its infrastructure and cities were destroyed, thousands of people being killed and injured and maimed and so. But at the same time, unless there is awareness and there is maturity and vision to not to take revenge, not to take vendetta with all the horrors that happen in the country, if there's no awareness, I think, yes, there's also the potential for fractions and infighting, and God forbid, an Iraqi or Somali or Afghani example being repeated in Libya. I'm not sure, though. So far, I think the leadership has been very, very coordinated, had only one crisis, the assassination of General Yunus. But other than that, I think so far so good. And the liberation of Tripoli, as I said, has been impressive. But it doesn't mean the challenges ahead for the Libyan revolution is going to be easy. Actually, the challenge will be tremendous. And as you said, coordinating between the leadership in the West and the East, making sure that there will be no looting, making sure that people who lost good, beloved ones, and make sure that the bitterness and the natural human tendency to really react is put in a larger context where the country could heal its wounds.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and author of The Making of Modern Libya. You mentioned earlier that you have information that the whole piece of theater with Saif al-Islam, the idea that he was captured by the rebels, was actually invented by him and his own people, and they staged that as a way to get media attention, as a propaganda move to make it look like they're still a formidable force, that they're still something to be reckoned with. I was speaking yesterday to a former CIA officer who seems to have very good connections, just on the matter of General Yunus that you mentioned, who was assassinated. I was told yesterday that that was actually done by his own tribe. It wasn't the Islamists. Do you have any information on that?
It's still very, very unclear to us what are really the facts about what happened then. And even the council in Benghazi that's leading the uprising wasn't very clear. So I think we're going to know more about it later on. There are conflicting narrative about that, and I'm not sure this is really resolved yet. Let me just add one. There are two threats to the uprising, Ian. There is a threat from not only the challenges and the problems of destroyed, country now. Let's hope that the allies, the NATO countries, and our own government in the United States will resist the temptation to impose its own agenda after helping the Libyan uprising. I think that's very crucial, because that will mean we'll go back to the monarchy and radicalization of new generation of young Libyans. It's very, very important, despite the blood and the suffering. It was a battle that Libyan society, in my opinion, had to fight and resolve it. And even though it took longer, but I think Libya has the potential to really create a more stable democratic republic.
Well, it's very interesting and to see some of the political reactions to what's happening in Libya, in the West, and here in the United States. It seems that on the left, and of course the left in this country is not particularly strong or influential, but I think one of the things that's happening is that they're discrediting themselves by appearing not to be very happy about the fact that the Libyan people have liberated themselves and the terrible tyrant, a murderous thief who's exploited this country mercilessly for 42 years is all but finished. And one of the things that strikes me about the irony about this is that from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela to people like Denis Kucinich over here, they focus only on NATO bombing, not on the extent to which the Libyan people, almost all of them as far as I can tell, except for the people on Gaddafi's payroll, rose up initially. And then they had no arms, and then he threatened to slaughter them all. And then they painfully fought their way back. Obviously, they've been supplied by the West. And you're quite right to suggest that if the West tries to cash in on this victory, it would be a complete disaster. I think it would backfire very poorly. But just given the fact that, for example, all of the east of Tripoli is poor working-class industrial area, they are entirely in support of the rebels. In the West, the affluent area, all of whom are Gaddafi's cronies, they are supporting him. So if you're on the side of the working class, for God's sake, you have to support the rebels, don't you?
Well, I think I hear the critique of this war from a segment of our own left in the United States. And I think it doesn't excuse the NATO allies. It doesn't excuse some of the policies that our own government in the past in the United States did it. But I think so far, the dictatorship inside Libya was rejected by the majority of the Libyan people, and we have to respect their choices. It would be really very, very disingenuous to assume that we can talk on behalf of the Libyan people. That's the first thing. The second thing is the jury is still out. Whether this liberation is going to be a true liberation or the country will become a client state or not, whether that's going to be a democratic civil republic or something really giving back to some opportunistic elite, this is, we don't know. For now, we know that this is really a good moment, and Libyan people, with the help of the NATO, yes, they fought very hard for their liberation. And thank God, and I advocated that for a long time, that no troops on the ground, that they fought for 6 months, and Libya seems to be on the verge of being free. Now, what happens after now, there is no a very rosy, clear picture. There is a potential for maybe a model country. There is also potential for becoming really a terrible example. And the revolutions free us to think in all kind of possibilities. This is the crossroads that Libya is in right now. It's a good moment. It was a good war. And the Libyan people are victorious.
Well, of course, history is full of examples of revolutions that bring forth enormous hope, like the Iranian Revolution, arguably the Russian Revolution, and then 20 years ago when Yeltsin came into power and the communists fell, it's eventually been stolen by Putin and the KGB.
Yeah.
So it can change, of course, and we all should be aware of it. But I'm just suggesting that we have to have in our political DNA a little bit of respect for humanities and for this universal desire for freedom. And
we need to educate ourselves. I see a lot of pundits, even scholars, reducing Libyan society to tribal identities and regional faces without allowing Libyans to talk for themselves and without thinking about the fact Libyan society, which is the irony of Gaddafi's long government, populist government that became a police state, is Libyan society has one of the highest literacy rates in the region. Also, 80% of the Libyan people live in cities. Libya is now very urbanized, and you're going to see people who really use this cliche and simplistic lenses of tribalism and tribal identities. And I think that's a very misleading way of understanding Libyan society. Libyan society is more than Gaddafi. Libyan society is more than oil. Libyan society is more than also the idea of pre-modern or anti-modern ideas that we've been thinking about since the Iranian Revolution. We are talking about people with faces and voices, and they look very much, their demands are like us. they have universal claims. And that's really crucial if we want to understand why liberal society is really alienated. And finally, when it gives up on reform, began to really say, you can't reform this regime. We are forced to carry arms, unfortunately. And this is their moment now. Where we go from here, it could be anything. But I think let's not spoil the moment. It's a good war. It was a good uprising made of a variety of people, of middle and working class and educated youth. And for that matter, it was a really a popular uprising. Let's now hope that this revolution will not be stolen.
Well, I'm optimistic, Ali Abdelatif Hamida, only in as much as we've seen what happened with the young in Egypt. It started out with the students, and then the working class people joined in the revolution, and then the Muslim Brotherhood joined in the revolution.
Yes.
And they're not letting go. They're not trusting the military, and they're still taking to Tahrir Square.
That's right.
And I'm encouraged, for example, in Syria, which I think is similar to Libya. Again, the poorest part of Syria, working class town of Deraa, is where the revolution started. And in the poor neighborhoods of Damascus, this is where the revolution is coming. This is why I can't understand the leftists don't understand that this is actually a left-wing revolution, in the sense that it's the working class against these corrupt elites, these kleptocratic regimes run by families.
Yeah, for a long time, Ian, the Libyan people did not want to march in the street. Actually, the irony in Libya is that had the regime not blowing all the attempts to reform the system in the last 10 years, there would be no revolution in Libya. I think Libyan people were really patient and generous, waiting for real reform about their lives, their schools, their clinics, their future, fighting corruption, you know, having a rule of law, having more freedom of expression and association. And they waited and they waited. And when Gaddafi sent his security forces to shoot on people, people said, you cannot reform this regime. And that's really the reality of it. And right now, I think we see a battle that was forced on the Libyan people because they want to have a peaceful protest. But when the army was sent there, people were found themselves in the corner. And one final note, Ian, I have to comment. I think Muslim or Islamic organization or movement, not all of them of the same type. Some are probably are intolerant and extremist and jihadist. But a lot of groups and movements, they are not really extremist. And it's very important that as we look at Catholic Church playing roles, Christian activists or groups playing a role, or social democracy in Europe, there are some of these groups who might play a very, very vital role in the political process in the future. And I think it's important not to lump the jihadists, Al-Qaeda, all these very, very intolerant groups with every social movement that aspire or inspired by Muslim ideals.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Professor Ali Abdelatif.
Thank you, Ian, for having me again. And let's hope that I will talk about Libya a year from now or 2 years, a stable, civil, democratic republic, as we all hope for the Libyan people.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Professor Ali Abdelatif Hamida, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He is the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Let's take a brief station break now. We'll be back talking about what Libya might look like in a decade from now.
I'm
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and joining us now is Daniel Sowa, who is a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Imagining Libya a Decade from Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Sowa.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And given your past in the Bosnian wars in terms of bringing about human rights conditions, obviously there's a great concern now of perhaps possible fault lines amongst the rebels given that the Western rebels seem to be the more effective fighters. The Eastern rebels have gotten all the recognition but have hardly made any military advances. So there's concern now that there may be retribution and human rights abuses. What is your understanding of the control over the rebels that the Libyan governing body has?
The National Transitional Council has only modest control, I would say, over the what they say are 47 different militias that are fighting for the rebel cause. This is a big problem, and they're trying to gain better control. They're trying to support their fighters more effectively as well, and those two things are linked. When you support your fighters better, they're likely to salute you as well. I would be concerned about all of the things you mentioned, internecine violence among the rebels, revenge killing. I'd be concerned about rioting and looting. I'd be concerned about all of these things. But the fact is that for the most part, these things have not happened yet in the areas that have already been liberated. And the reason for that is, at least in part, that Libyans organize themselves in local community councils, which provide some minimal governing structure.
So you think then, because much of the criticism that one hears, obviously people like Chavez in Venezuela railing about NATO bombing, and there is some support still, I think, on the left for Gaddafi. I don't know how, given that this is such a working-class revolution against him. I mean, the poor people in eastern Libya are the ones, eastern Tripoli, are the ones that are supporting the rebels. It's the wealthy elite and Gaddafi's cronies in the western part of the city that support him. And the same is true in Syria, by the way. I'm kind of astounded as to why there's any residual belief that somehow Gaddafi is a revolutionary hero, given the 42-year kleptocratic reign of brutality and
well, if you owe your business and your role in life entirely to this autocrat, either in Syria or in Libya, you're likely to support him even though you know better because you had a good education and you're a businessman. There are Gaddafi supporters, and the National Transitional Council have been very good about calling on the rebels not to take revenge, not to exclude people who have fought on the side of Gaddafi. They've been remarkable about this. I think it will stand them in good stead. A cycle of revenge violence would only excite more resistance, and that would be very bad for Libya.
Well, my understanding is that that even with the capture of Tripoli, which I guess is all but inevitable, and that, of course, Libya is a very urban country. I think 90% of the population live in the cities. But then there's this vast area in the south that Gaddafi controls, not to mention Sirte, his hometown. Do you think that this is going to take a little bit of time after the dust settles in Tripoli before the Gaddafi regime is totally finished?
It will take time. And, you know, there may always be people living in the south who are nostalgic about Gaddafi's regime. They're entitled to that. But I think you will see the main population centers under rebel control. It won't be rebel control anymore. It'll be National Transitional Council control. I hope sooner rather than later. Gaddafi is doing his country one last evil deed, which is continuing resistance when he knows perfectly well that the jig is up. What he should be doing is arranging to turn over power, to relinquish power, leave the country or go into retirement, do whatever he's going to do, but make it clear to his supporters that he doesn't expect them to fight anymore. That would be a gesture of statesmanship that you can't really expect from Gaddafi, but it would certainly be the best possible thing for Libya.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Sowa. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Imagining Libya a Decade from Now. And let's go to that scenario of what might happen in a decade from now. It seems to me that the worst thing that could happen is that NATO and the West could in any way revive any notion of colonial interference, because my understanding, the Libyans are fiercely independent, and even though I'm sure the rebels are grateful for NATO's help, do you think that the Western powers are subtle enough to keep their footprint out of it as much as possible?
I think they're trying very hard to keep their footprint out of it as much as possible, and I don't think they'll go in unless they're invited to go in. But I personally believe that the Libyans may want some military police-type units to help stabilize the situation in Tripoli, but it's yet to be seen whether they're going to need that. If they ask, I hope we'll be positive about responding, but I hasten to add that I hope it won't be Americans who respond. I hope it'll be Europeans. European interests are much more directly at stake in Libya than American interests. They're the ones with oil and gas investments there. They're the ones who burn the oil and gas that comes from Libya. They're the ones who fear Libyan migration. They're the ones attached to Libya by pipelines. And I think they should take on the bulk of this burden.
So in terms of the possibility of chaos, autocracy, and partition, which are the three perils that you outline in your foreign policy article, Daniel Sowa, what indications are there? Of course, obviously, it's very early in the day to suggest that, I mean, I guess a country had been ruled by a dictatorship, was had no civil society, total autocracy. The institution of the military he totally eviscerated because he basically only was concerned about his own Praetorian Guard. So you won't have a situation like in Egypt where the military is the sort of the one institution that's left that seems to the public seem to support, although people are kind of wary of it. What's there? What's left? What institutions exist apart from
very
this?
Very little. It's a real major state-building project. Things have to be built from the ground up. One thing Libyans do, though, that not everybody else does, and it's a marvelous thing, is that they organize themselves in local councils. So the National Transitional Council doesn't actually govern the liberated areas, only in a very vague sense. In the liberated areas, local communities have developed their own councils. Even in Gaddafi-controlled areas, such local councils existed clandestinely. This is a marvelous thing that Libyans do, and I think shows a lot of promise for the future. In Benghazi, they also, rather quickly after the regime was kicked out, they organized large numbers of civil society organizations, advocacy organizations, relief organizations. And this, too, is a very good sign that despite the brutality, the deprivations of the Gaddafi period, that Libyans have grown to understand what it means to be able to govern yourself. And they are moving to do it rather more quickly than I ever would have imagined.
So the fault lines between the East and the West that seem to be evident, and particularly with the lightning-fast emergence of the Western rebels, the Berbers from the mountains, I believe clandestinely armed largely by the French, but they seem to be the ones that have taken the military initiative. And I'm wondering that since all the support has gone to the Benghazi East, the National Transition Council, will there be any fissures between the people who actually liberated the city and those that have the political connections to the West?
Well, it'd be surprising if there weren't a few tensions. But frankly, my understanding is that the Western rebels got quite a bit of support out of Benghazi as well. I think we don't know the whole story here yet. This East-West tension, which does exist in Libya, which was kind of cobbled together by the Italians, is often exaggerated. At the same time, I think we have to be very careful to not allow it to become a real split. Things do tend to fall apart along the lines that they were put together. We know that from fixing vases. And we have to watch that with great care. But I know that the National Transitional Council is also watching it with great care, and they are trying to incorporate representatives from the newly liberated areas as rapidly as possible. That's a really vital next step.
And what kind of resources do they have? I know Gaddafi had a lot of money stashed abroad, billions and billions in foreign banks. He was going through that money buying mercenaries and weapons there in this six-month-long war that he appears to have all but lost. What's going to be left?
He should not have gone through any of that money since the Security Council resolution passed. Anything that was held outside the country, and I think we have reason to believe that a very large percentage of the money was held outside the country, would have been frozen right after the Security Council resolution passed. There's over $30 billion in the United States. And unfortunately, it's going to take some time to free it up. In the meanwhile, there are some other countries that have moved more rapidly to unfreeze the assets. And my understanding is that there are some Arab countries that have stepped in with some bridge financing, if I can call it that. Libya, I've rarely seen a post-war situation that wouldn't have benefited from having less money. So I'm not as concerned as most people are about this money question, but I do believe that the National Transitional Council needs a steady flow of adequate financing and needs to be able to deliver some peace dividend to the Libyan people. But that should... You know, it's going to be a long time before they run out of I think it's $34 billion in the United States. They have massive assets at their disposal. The question of when the oil and gas production starts is a big question mark. People who know the situation better than I do say that it won't start up until things are much more stable than they are today.
Well, we know that Daniel Sowa, again, professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Study and scholar at the Middle East Institute, author of an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy, Imagining Libya a Decade from Now. Obviously, Gaddafi was obsessed with buying weapons, and he certainly wasn't taking care of his own people, but he just loved to spend money on weaponry, and there's stashes of it all around the country, a little bit like Saddam Hussein. And we know that the Saddam Hussein's caches of weapons weren't sufficiently guarded when the U.S. Invaded Iraq, and they ended up being used against American forces. What's the possibility here of these caches of weapons ending up in, for example, in the hands of some of the Islamist militias? Because there's been one of the ironies of our relationship prior to this revolution with Gaddafi was that Gaddafi was good at rounding up al-Qaeda people before they showed up in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Even before they joined al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
There's a big problem here about the weapons. I'm not so much concerned with the small arms. You know, frankly, there's nothing you can do to significantly reduce the number of AK-47s available to Libyans today. It's just it's a hopeless problem. But there are weapons like the surface-to-air missiles, the shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, the chemical weapons that are very dangerous and should not be allowed to get into circulation in world markets. There is a serious possibility of a continuing resistance movement. And that is a very dangerous thing, and these weapons caches would help such a movement to survive. But I don't see the kind of popular support emerging for the resistance movement in Libya that you saw in at least some communities in Iraq. Now, those communities regretted supporting the resistance in the early days and turned around and regretted it with arms. But I don't see signs of popular support for a continuing Gaddafi loyalist resistance.
Well, though, just touching on the chemical weapons, which of course are just a very disturbing notion, they're in the what's called the WMD category, weapons of mass destruction. I know that we made that deal to forgive and forget over Lockerbie and to get for him to give up his ambitions for weapons of mass destruction, and apparently quite a bit of information about the activities of AQ Khan emerged from that particular source out of Libya. But they do have chemical weapons. I believe they got sarin and some other forms of gas in artillery shells. The U.S. has been in there for some time, apparently working on neutralizing this stockpile. What's the status of it, do you know?
I do not know a lot about the status. I had heard not about sarin, but about mustard gas, which is a pretty useless weapon, by the way. Look, I'm not sure on that front. I'd be much more concerned about the shoulder-fired anti-aircraft weapons, if in fact they do exist.
Well, yes, in as much as they could find their way, go south. I mean, already apparently there's a tremendous arms bazaar going on down in Chad. I've been...
Well, I'm not surprised. And, you know, wherever there's insecurity and conflict and tension, you're going to find arms. But there are some arms that are worse than others. And I hope that we can at least gather up those that are a real threat on an international scale.
Well, just in closing then, when I get notes from listeners saying, who are the National Transitional Council? What can you tell us that's in any way reassuring? Because obviously people are concerned.
Well, I think, who are they? They are a very broad spectrum, what I would call a big tent. They have secularists, they have Islamists, they have Easterners, they have Westerners, they have all different tribes involved. The people I've met from the NTC are well-educated Libyans, some of them people who spend a long time abroad, others who've never been abroad. It's a hodgepodge, but that's exactly what it should be to write a constitution for the country, because what you need to write a constitution is a very broad consensus in the population that this is how they want power distributed, this is the kind of government they want. The time for political competition will come later. And it will be a ferocious competition, I have no doubt. But I hope it can be a nonviolent competition, that the political competition can be channeled into parliament, into local city councils, into the courts where appropriate. Libya has an enormous opportunity here. I think the situation is not comparable to Iraq because you don't have the Americans, you don't have the occupation, you don't have this heavy international presence, and you have a genuinely popular uprising against the autocrat. So I have some hopes that in the longer term, and I don't think this will look pretty in 6 months or a year or even 2 years, but I'm hopeful that in a time frame of 5 to 10 years, it will look a hell of a lot better than it did under Gaddafi.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Daniel Sowa.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sowa, who's a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Imagining Libya a Decade from Now. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the shifting sand, if you will, in the broader Middle East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who is a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He serves as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Ginsburg.
Thank you to have me again.
And I know last time we spoke, you were very concerned that the United States was sitting on its hands vis-a-vis Assad's brutality in Syria. And there have been some movements on that. But how do you think recent events in Libya are impacting the situation in Syria?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think it. I think we have to see how the last chapter of this revolution in Libya plays out. Clearly, the Syrian people have had to endure their own share of pain and suffering the way the Libyan people have had to endure for the last 6 months. We really have no idea what the costs have been in either country yet. That has yet to be tallied. I suspect that many Syrians are looking at this and saying, well, if we only had the arms, we could take on the regime. The difference, of course, between Libya and Syria is that the Libyans were given and granted weapons by NATO and by other Arab League states, and at the same time, the Syrian people are defenseless and fighting with words.
So one of the things that I see in common here is and it's interesting to see that it's in some quarters on the left, there's criticism, of course, of NATO, no sense of that the Libyan people freed themselves from a 42-year dictatorship of a kleptocrat who murdered people and stole the country blind. I mean, interesting enough, in the east of Tripoli, it's a working-class neighborhood, industrial area. Everybody supports the rebels. In the west part, which is the affluent area, all of, you know, Gaddafi's cronies, of course, support him. And it seems to be a similar situation in Syria, in as much as that in the poorer areas, the revolution began in Deraa on the border there, a very poor town. The suburbs of Damascus that oppose us, the Assads, are all very working class. And the parts of Damascus that support the Assads are the cronies. So do you see this kind of paradox that this is a sort of working class revolt against kleptocrats, but yet, it's not getting support from the international left.
Well, I understand exactly what you say. I mean, and you have it quite right. I mean, the people who are the crony kleptocrats around Gaddafi enrich themselves to an incredible degree. And, of course, the Assad family was in Assad Family Inc. They rewarded the people who were loyal to them, particularly the mercantile class in Damascus and in Aleppo, the two major cities. And as a result, there's been not only a decision by these classes, these business classes, not to support the revolutions, but they've also more or less realized that when the revolutions succeed, they're the ones who are going to be losing out big time.
So what explains this confusion? Is it just that we have this kind of romantic idea about revolutionaries? And because I always try to make an effort to talk to the real people in countries, talk to Libyans about Libya, Syrians about Syria, and I'm just wondering what explains this constant refrain here that NATO is all imperialism, it's the bombing of NATO, and nobody's focusing on the idea that these people freed themselves so much as the West is going in on some neo-imperialist adventure.
Well, look, there's no doubt that without NATO's military support, the rebels would have been defeated by the Gaddafi military. That's a given. I don't think anyone would dispute that who knows what happened on the ground. That being said, it was Libyan blood that was shed on the ground. These were young people who rose up and who were left more or less without a lot of support. Remember, this war was not going in their favor until the last few weeks. And in Syria, NATO is not involved. Obviously, the people in Syria are courageous and brave, standing up to the brute repression and murder squads of the Iranian-Syrian militias that are there firing on them. The fact of the matter is that the key test will be whether or not the Libyan people are grateful to the let's not put NATO in the context. This is the United States. This is Britain and France. Will they be grateful to this military support that they received that enabled them to get rid of this 42-year-old dictatorship? And that'll be the test, because in the rest of the Arab world, neither NATO, the United States, Great Britain, or France are given a lot of credit for any of the revolutions that have occurred.
But surely there's a tremendous residual suspicion of the West and an anti-colonial history here that you'd have to be sensitive about. It seems to me that the last thing that NATO and the United States should do is start, putting any kind of footprint on the ground in Libya.
Well, obviously, and this is going to be the ironic paradox. Can the Transitional National Council in Libya find the wherewithal and get unified support from the tribal leaders and other elements of the society in the country, particularly the western part of the country, to help stabilize Tripoli and prevent the type of lawlessness, looting, and breakdown of law and order that we saw in Baghdad after Saddam toppled? And if they cannot control this, then it's clear that there'll be other elements who will fill the vacuum, and this is obviously not to our benefit. Will NATO put troops on the ground? I doubt it. Will there be some other, perhaps, effort to try to stabilize the situation by providing logistical support and transforming this ragtag army into a police force? Well, that's going to take time. It took time. It takes time, whether it was in Kosovo or Bosnia or anywhere else.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. What do you make, though, of this division in the sense of the effectiveness of the Western rebels and, in part, the Berbers, and the fact that the East has been where the National Transitional Council have been getting all the support, international support, for the longest time, but they made very little military progress, and it seems to be the Western rebels are the ones that took Tripoli at lightning speed. Do you think there's a possible fault line there between the Eastern and the Western rebels?
You took the phrase right out of my mouth. There is a fault line between East and West. There's residual unhappiness and potential recrimination on the part of the Western rebels and tribal leaders in the western part of the country who stood up to Gaddafi and felt that they did not get the support they deserved from the Transitional National Council. It'll remain to be seen whether or not that injury can be repaired by the TNC.
And I don't mean to move around all the region so much, but just back to Syria, there's some interesting developments, Ambassador Ginsburg, going on with Hamas, for example. Hamas is breaking with Damascus. Apparently, it's freaking out Tehran. And that the attack on the Israeli bus on the Egyptian border was engineered by a Iranian proxy group Obviously, the Iranians are trying to do whatever they can to change the subject here to get people back on thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian issue and not the brutality of the Assads. What's your understanding of these shifting alliances?
Well, look, let's be clear. Assad is completely 100% dependent on Tehran's logistical, financial, and military support to stay in power. Without which, it's the equivalent of NATO that has come to his rescue. It's the Iranian version of NATO that is providing him the military means to accomplish his objectives. And Hamas, which never had any particular allegiance to Damascus, even though there were elements that were based there, is almost a wholly owned and bought and paid for by Tehran. So it is quite clear that the Iranians are particularly interested, on the one hand, of supporting Damascus. On the other hand, it is unclear, given the vicissitudes of the Muslim Brotherhood's relationship with Hamas in Egypt, how the Hamas is able to play this, because on the one hand, they're dependent on Iran. On the other hand, they're beholden to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
Well, and it doesn't help, surely, if Assad is sending his navy to shoot up Palestinian refugee camps in Latakia.
Yeah, where is all the outcry in the Arab world to the fact that the Syrians targeted a Palestinian refugee camp in Latakia and in effect, it was an assault of deadly dimensions on these Palestinian refugees? Why was that undertaken by the Syrians? Well, this only goes to show you the brazen indifference that the Syrians have had towards the Palestinians that live within their own country. By the way, it's a further evidence that the Assad regime considers the Palestinians living inside Syria as a fifth column to the Assad regime.
Well, I would think though that this is going to have repercussions in Lebanon and in the Palestinian territories.
Well, look, this is such a complicated stew. It's going to be hard to unravel it. Even those of us who follow this are having a hard time trying to decipher what is the game plan that's going on here that would bring such brute force against the Palestinians by the Syrians and Iranians.
So what do you think is Israel's position here? Because Israel and the United States have been fairly ambivalent. One of the things that puzzles me is, the old expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, if Tehran, the IRGC regime, is our enemy, and they're propping up Assad, why aren't we doing everything we can to cut the legs out from under him, and the Israelis too? So,
well, that's a $64,000 question. It's clear that the controversy over NATO's involvement in Libya more or less cut the ground out from any appetite by the United States or the West to involve themselves in Syria. There's all sorts of diplomatic platitudes that are tossed around. We can't involve ourselves. The United States cannot influence events. This is really up to Turkey and the Syrian people. The Turks are playing their own game here. They obviously have invested an enormous amount with the Assad regime. In the end, they're still praying and pleading with Assad to reform so that they don't lose their investment and lose their ability to influence Iran and Syria, because that's part of their own foreign policy dimensions in that part of the world. It is not consistent with U.S. objectives. So there's a lot of underlying maneuvering and diplomatic shady games going on here.
But and I guess that you have to add to that the dimension of Iraq right next door, because Maliki, of course, is pretty much, my interpretation of George W. Bush's Iraq war was that Iran won it. And that Maliki is obviously on the Iranian side, but surely what's left of the Sunni opposition there in Anbar, isn't it inevitable that they would form some kind of an alliance and even perhaps supply arms to the Brotherhood next door in Syria?
Well, I think the Brotherhood has largely been decimated in Syria. Number one, number two. There's no doubt that Maliki has basically decided to become a more of a puppet of the Iranian government when it comes to Syria. breaking more or less with his other Arab brethren in the Arab League, largely because he's beholden to Iran as well. And so you have that other dimension. I don't know. It's right now, without arms coming to the Syrian people to be able to stand up to the military might of the regime, there's no doubt that this is going to be an extraordinarily painful war of attrition by the Syrian opposition against this regime.
And do you think that that these belated moves on the part of the Western powers to start isolating the Assad's economically, the sanctions, the export of oil, import of refined products, is that going to affect the elite?
There's no doubt. That is really the Achilles heel of this government, of the Assad government. They get about $15 million a day in revenue from oil exports. You choke that off, then all bets are off. But you know what? Neither the British nor the Germans nor the Turks have signaled that they're willing to abide by this international call by the United States to impose sanctions on Syrian oil exports. So this may be more a theoretical exercise in futility than an actual punishment on the Syrian regime. It remains to be seen.
Well, but what explains that? I mean, we're not talking about a lot of money here, so I don't understand that duplicity.
Well, you know what? Please ask the British Prime Minister why he came up with the alibi that he doesn't want to restrict the import of oil from Syria because it would make, quote, harm the Syrian people, unquote.
I see. So you're not, obviously, Ambassador Ginsburg, you don't think a lot's going to happen on that front. It's going to be a long and painful process involving the spilling of blood on the part of these brave Syrians?
Yes, I'm afraid that the tipping point has been reached. Most of the cities in Syria are now under lockdown. Aleppo and Damascus did not revolt, and the military stayed more or less cohesive with the Assad regime, and I think that portends doom and gloom for these brave, courageous Syrian revolutionaries.
So would that then mean that Iranians have been successful in shoring up that regime?
Yes.
So it's a victory for Tehran?
For the time being, we'll see what happens.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg.
Thank you.
Again, I mean, speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He serves as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.